We're going to do what we rarely do here. We're going to do more of a panoramic piece. Normally we get more focused on atomistic things or modular things. Parsha Toldot, like Parshat Chayesara, really has three stories to it. Right? Chayesara has the purchase of Machpelah, the finding of Rivka, and then the end-of-life scenarios for Avraham and Ishmael. Here we also have three stories. We have the story of the birth and growing up and sale of the Bechora, that thing. We have the whole story of Yitzchak and Grar, and we've talked about that a few years ago, and I'm going to just quickly do a survey of that piece, which is all on the page. And then we have perhaps the most famous scene, I don't know, the whole Hakol Kol Yaakov Adami De'Esav scene where Yaakov is imitating or pretending, disguises himself as Esav. He gets the bracha, and then Esav comes in, and the result of all that is that Yaakov has to leave home. Now, the interesting thing about this, which I take very personally, is the fact that Yitzchak really is not a star of anything. If you think about it, in Parshat Chayesara, Rivka does a lot more than Yitzchak does, and the slave is really the star of that story. Yitzchak doesn't appear in the Marat Machpelah story, and he only appears at the end when it says that he buried Avram and that Avram gave everything he had to Yitzchak. But he doesn't play a central role as an actor. In Toldot, he plays a little bit of a role at the beginning, but quickly the camera shifts to Yaakov and Esau. And then we have this whole chapter of Yitzchak acting independently in the area of Gerar. We'll talk about where that is in a moment. And so, you know, I, as a Yitzchak, I'm kind of take that personally. The fact that, as some wag once said, Yitzchak was basically Avram's son and Yaakov's father, right? Because Yitzchak's way, way more than that. And so I want to actually skip to source 2, which the English of source 2 is on the back, if you want to see it. It takes up the whole back, because the English has a tendency to do that, to run on and on. What happens in Grar is basically five mini-scenes that take place. The first mini-scene, people are more familiar with only because, or should we say guys are more familiar with, or shulgoers are more familiar with, because you hear it four times. You hear it Shabbat afternoon, you hear it Monday morning, you hear it Thursday morning, and then you hear it again Shabbat morning at the beginning of the laning, and that is that Yitzchak wants to go to Egypt because there's a famine. Instead, Hashem stops him and says, you stay here. Here is Gerar. Where is Gerar? So if you're in Beersheba, where Yitzchak lives, and you want to go to Egypt, how do you go? You take a bus. But in those days, how do you go? You got to go west. You must go west. If you go south, you will die. Right. So you go west to the coast, area near or just above Ratzuat Aza, and then you catch Via Maris, which is the coast road. Via Maris is a late, more recent name. It's a Roman name. But Derech Eretz Plishtim. And you walk then on the coast all the way to El Arish and all the way to Ismaila, and then you're in Egypt and at the delta. Because if you try to go the other way, you're going to die. You're in the desert. There's nothing there. And so Yitzchak heads west to go towards Mitzrayim. It's odd for us to think west, but that's the direction he goes. And he gets to Grar, and he's about to continue going. And then Hashem says, stop here, you stay here, you're not leaving the country. And then there's a lot of interesting parshanut on why that is. The next thing is that Yitzchak's in Grar. And I mean, what you'll hear here is an interesting echo. Yitzchak is in Grar, and in Grar, he somehow lets the word out that he's traveling with his sister, who evidently is good-looking. At no point is she ever taken by Avimelech, although Avimelech has an interest in her. This is not the same Avimelech. Avimelech's a title name. So there's Avimelech the second or the third or the 15th or whatever. Right, it's not the same guy as back in the days of Abraham. Or might not be. And he sees them through the window sporting. Clearly they're doing something that brothers and sisters don't do outside of West Virginia, and so they, you know, they're making out, they're talking, you know, whatever it is, they're doing something that makes it clear that they're husband and wife. Avimelech understands what's going on, and he calls Yitzchak on the carpet for it, and what he says is something bad almost happened, which means he was interested in taking her, but it didn't. The next thing is that Yitzchak gets an order of protection, and nobody can mess with him because, you know, he's seen as a holy man. And then he starts farming in the area of Gerar, and he's very successful. Which, by the way, is very interesting because why did he leave Beersheba? Because there was a famine, which means there's a drought. and either the drought is over or they've got some sort of interesting irrigation system there, or else he's got an amazing blessing where every plant grows in spite of the drought. But he plants, and parenthetically, an interesting thing takes place. If you take a look on source 2 in the Hebrew, take a look at Pasuk Yod Bet, which is right about in the middle, and it says that Yitzchak planted and he found Me'ah She'arim. He found Me'ah She'arim. All right, what does Me'ah She'arim mean? What does that mean? He planted, right, so what it means is, what's a shar? A shar is the rate, is the value of the going rate for something. Me'ah She'arim seems to mean that he got either 100 times as much as he planted, or 100 times more than the yield would be, to be expected. So, just as a parenthesis, in 1880, I'm guessing six, I don't know, something like that, or in the 1890s, when there was a terrible housing crunch in Yerushalayim, in the old city, and if a corporation was formed to allow for spacious housing outside of the old city, which that wall had already been broken, because we had Nachlat Shiva, Mishkenot Shanim, we had several neighborhoods, and the neighborhood was called Me'ah She'arim, and the idea was that it would be, you know, plenty of room. Tour guides Ad Hayom Hazeh, when they take people around Me'ah She'arim, say there used to be 100 gates here. Right? Amaratzis. Anyhow.
So where did the gate come from?
What?
How did the gate come out of the word Shar?
No, good question. I don't know. Very likely, it could be that, or it could be that, not a synonym, even a homonym, or it could be that it's a that it's because the Shar is where they set that price. Could be that it's a court set thing. In any case, he plants. Now, he then goes around and finds all these wells that Avram had dug when he was there. The plishtim had filled them in, and he redigs them. Now, filling in wells is a really dumb thing to do. There's only one reason to do it, and that is you want nobody to have the water. It's not a cistern, it's a well. A cistern, I understand, you're filling it in because we want to move it somewhere else. Cistern, you're collecting water, so collect it somewhere else. To a well, though, is getting natural water from an underground aquifer. To fill it in is just suicide. And Eretz Yisrael is just a really dumb thing to do. Which means that what they're doing is they're trying to sabotage other people's efforts, which is essentially what we call terrorism. Because terrorism, anybody who's a terrorist in their own neighborhood is hurting their own neighborhood, but they'd rather hurt the other guy than to have a good neighborhood or a good area. In any case, that happens. And then he starts digging wells and gets in fights with the plishtim, and he names the wells after those fights, and then finally finds an area that they don't touch him. And then he moves back to Beersheba, and Avimelech follows him to Beersheba, and Avimelech wants to make a brit. He makes a shivuah, and therefore calls the name Be'er Sheva, and then finds out that they dug and found a well there, which if you count is actually the seventh well in this whole story. And so it gets called Beersheba. So why is it called Beersheba? Is it called Beersheba because it's well number seven? Is it Beersheba because going back to when Avraham set aside seven lambs to make the brit with Avimelech in that same place? Or is it called Beersheba because of the oath, Shvuah? Good question. So all up for grabs. But what do you hear in this? And that's the story that takes you all the way to the end of the parasha, near the bottom of the page, Pasuk Lamed Gimel. Now what do you hear in that story? Is every one of those stories is an echo of an Avraham story. And as Rav Amnon Bazak pointed out, I showed this a few years ago, in every case, Yitzchak actually improves on Avraham. Avraham goes to Egypt, Yitzchak wants to go, is stopped. Avraham says, she's my sister, and Sarah gets taken to Paro, and Sarah gets taken to Avimelech. Rivka never gets taken, right? Avraham has to keep moving around. Yitzchak's actually able to settle down and stand off against the plishtim. And most tellingly, at the end, when Avimelech comes and wants an oath, Avraham goes further than an oath and makes a brit. And the very famous Rashbam that we saw 2 weeks ago, that God gets angry that he made a brit, and that's the akedah as the punishment. That in Yitzchak, he asked for a brit. Yitzchak's only willing to take a shuah. He's not willing to go further. Not actually make a covenant, but just an oath of non-aggression, which is less of a treaty type of thing. But all these stories happen in Grar. Now, I want to look at the broader question, because the broader question is what the panoramic piece. How does Parsha Toldot start? It starts with Yitzchak is the son of Avram. Let's read it through. Ve'elot Toldot Yitzchak ben Avram, Avram hovid et Yitzchak. Many of the English underneath.
Vayitzchak ben 40 shana bekachtor Rivka ben Petuel Armin Pazan Aram Achot Lavan Armin Lo Leisha. And how old is Rivka at the time? We have no idea. We have no idea. Certainly over 12, because, you know, nobody gets married younger than that, but 12, 15, whatever it is, the Midrash is 14. All right. Vayetar Yitzchak la'adonai lenochach ishto ki akarahi. So Yitzchak prays. Why does he pray? Because she is barren, and he's praying for a child. And this, of course, is now a repeat. You know, Sarah was barren, although we never found out I'm praying, or Sarah praying. But here we find Yitzchak praying. Vayater lo Adonai v'tar Rivka ishto. God responds, and Rivka gets pregnant. Famous piece. Vayrotetzu abanim bekira, which actually means the kids are crushing each other inside of her. Lama Zanochi has a wide range of commentary what that means. It means, why me? Meaning, why did I get myself into this mess to start with? The pregnancy is so painful. Or, why am I having a harder pregnancy than all the other girls I talk to? Or, some of the Rishonim say, why am I alive? I wish I were dead. It's a wide range about that. So she seeks out God, which most Rishonim understand means she goes to a Navi or something to find out what's going on. God says the famous, famous line, which really sets all Jewish history in motion. You have two nations inside of you, two nations that are going to separate at birth. They will struggle with each other, which could mean the older one will be enslaved by the younger one, or it could mean the older one will enslave the younger one. But what it tells you is that there's not going to be a standoff. One of them is always going to be over the other one. All right, so they're always going to be in relationship. It'll be confrontational, and it will never be even. Okay. Now let's just, she gives birth, and they're twins, which is no surprise to us, and no surprise to her. The word vihine is always a word of surprise. So who's surprised? It seems from the rest of the story that Yitzchak is probably surprised, because it seems pretty clear that she never told him about this nevuah, from everything that plays out. She never told him about this nevuah at all. And so therefore the whole twins thing would be a surprise. All right, maybe it's a surprise to the midwives. We could do that. The first one comes out admoni. What does admoni mean, by the way?
Reddish.
Like ruddy skin, right? Who else is admoni in Tanakh?
David.
Famous? David, right? David does not have red hair. But David, they all have David with red hair. What?
One.
It seems like he has black hair. How do I know that? Because in the very famous Ferris Bueller scene, where David is in the house and Michal has him go out through the window, pulling that little Rachav move, and he goes out through the window, and then she pretends he's sick in bed, and she puts Trafim in bed, and what does she put on the pillow? Kvir Izim, goat hair. Goats typically are black. White hair wouldn't work for David. So it's probably black. Now, I had a student once. The year after that, his family went back to Israel, and he said, I was walking around, I actually saw a red-haired goat. Okay, could be. He killed it, and he sprayed the ashes, and then he found out it was supposed to be a cow, and he got in trouble. All right. Kuloka Deretziar, he's a very hairy kid. Vaikru Shmo Esav, they call him Esav. What does that name mean? Esav. Well done, basically. I mean, he's Asui. That's what it says. Asui. He's kind of done. He's finished. Right? Not finished in a bad way, but complete. Who comes out next? His brother. And the brother is holding on to the heel, famously. Yaakov. So he calls him. Who's he? We assume he is Yitzchak. Calls him Yaakov. Yitzchak 60. Now this is the first time we find out how long their barrenness was. They had a barren period of 20. Which, by the way, is interesting, because what did we already learn from Avram and Sarah? What's the norm in Canaan? After 10 years, you make some other arrangements. The concubine, whatever it is. Evidently, their monogamy was very strong, and they weren't interested in that, and they continued, and after 20 years, they finally had kids. Yitzchak 60, which allows us to know the age differential between them. It means they're 120 when he dies. We know that. And then we have the whole story of them growing up, and Esau being a farmer and a hunter, and Yaakov being a shepherd, and that takes us back to Cain and Hevel, and they don't get along. One parent favors this one parent favors that one, right? And then the famous story of Esau coming home one day and saying, I'm hungry, give me the red stuff, etc. Okay, we all know that, but here's where the problem sets in.
What happens after that story in the Torah? Vayihira ba'aretz. There's a famine. And Yitzchak goes down towards Egypt, and God says, you stay here. All right? So he stays in Gerar. What does he immediately announce about Rivka, or let people know? She's my sister. Why does he have to say that? He says, why? Because what is he afraid of? They're going to kill him to get her because she's so pretty. Right? Okay. There's a famine. Where'd they leave the kids? So you're going to tell me that Yaakov and Esav are already old enough that they're fending for themselves, but if Yitzchak and Rivka have to leave Beersheba because there's a famine, where are Esav and Yaakov? Where'd they go? But it gets worse. When Sarah, as old as she is, when she's evidently desired by these foreign kings, is still not with child and never had a child. Here we have Rivka, who's already got kids who are older, which means she's not only significantly older, but she's a mother who's older. It makes the story of the attraction and the fear that Yitzchak's going to be killed for her a little bit harder, and it also makes the scene, although it's not impossible, the scene of Yitzchak mitzachek and Rivka ishto, which sounds like lovebirds, young lovebirds, a little bit harder, but it's doable. But here's the part that's really difficult. What do we know from that first story about Esav's relationship with Yitzchak? What do we know? Esav loves Yitzchak. Esav has tremendous honor for Yitzchak, we find out later. But even right now, why does Yitzchak favor Esav? Kitzayid befiv. Esav feeds him. And Esav, like Yitzchak, is a field person. He's a farmer. Yitzchak's a farmer. And there's an affinity there.
A farmer or a
hunter? What? Ish sadeh. Your dad's side, Ish sadeh. That's two things. He's a farmer and a hunter, right? And Yaakov, in the meantime, is a shepherd, right? Toshev Wali. So we also find out later that as angry as Esav gets when the bracha is taken from him, and I want to kill Yaakov, what does he say? I'll wait till father's dead to kill Yaakov. Which if you think about it, for a guy like Esav, who's clearly got a problem with impulse control, to be able to say, but I'm not going to act on it till father's gone, tremendous honor for father. Okay, he loves father, and he's a hunter. So please tell me why, when Yitzchak is fighting with the Plishtim, Esav isn't hiding behind some tree, little Jack Bauer action, remind you, and has an arrow and shoots down some Plishtim. Why isn't Esav standing next to his father, like Tehillim Kuf Chav Zayin, the man who comes to the gate with his sons, like the arrows in the quiver, standing next to him to fight the enemy? Where's Esav in this whole thing? It's very strange. It's very odd. Now look at the bottom of page 1, which is also in English, at the bottom of page 2, a new paragraph. And there's a little note about Esav's marriage. Esav at 40 gets married. That's cool. Yitzchak got married at 40. Esav gets married at 40. And Esav marries two women, not one. They're both local girls. And Yitzchak and Rivka don't like them. That's what we're told. Right? We don't know why. We could think that maybe they're not happy that Esav married a local girl to start with. Maybe it could be that the girls themselves are not nice. Maybe they're doing Avodah Zarah. Maybe Yitzchak goes blind from the smoke of the incense they're burning to Avodah Zarah. We don't know. Lots of possibilities. But we do know that Esav gets married at 40. But take a look at the page, and I do this on purpose, deliberately. When I copy a piece of Tanakh from the thing, this doesn't look like a Sefer Torah. There's Tamei Mikra in it. I use a hey with a slash instead of Hashem's name. But I always mark out the parshiot the way they are on the Torah. So if you look at a Sefer Torah, you will see that after Arei Omazeh, there's a space of 9 letters, and then the next piece, because it's a new parsha. It's called a parsha stuma, but it's a new break. How come suddenly, after hearing the whole story of Yitzhak and Gerar, suddenly we're told, oh, by the way, Esau was 40 years old, and he got married. Wouldn't that be kind of close to where we left the story off? I mean, how old is Esau when he's hunting and wants the red stuff? So he's 20, 25, whatever. It's not that much later. It's not like a whole different lifetime. So why is that here? And why is it like a separate parasha? It's kind of bizarre.
Where should it be?
What?
Where would you put it? Where should it be?
I would have not separated it.
From
Arei Omazeh. In other words, let it be one flow. You know, you're telling the story of Yitzchak, so finish the story with Yitzchak,
Yitzchak married at 40 now. Esav married at 40, kind of a nice complete circle. Why are you separating it as a separate little piece?
Unless this whole middle section.
Okay, so now let's take a look at it. We have a principle in Torah, in Parshanut. It's a principle that Chazal, Masachet Pesachim Dafav, famous sugya, say, Ein Mukdam Mukhar BaTorah. What does that mean? What does that mean? Ein Mukdam Mukhar BaTorah. So, is that true or not true? Of course it's true. It's true because even the Ramban, who claims Yesh Mukdam Mukhar BaTorah, has to admit sometimes not true. Where's the most glaring example where it's not true? In the beginning of Bamidbar. The beginning of Bamidbar starts in the second year, in the second month of the second year that Bnei Yisrael left Mitzrayim. We would call Rosh Chodesh Iyar. A year after the Mitzrayim, a year and 2 weeks. Right? By the Baruch Adonai Moshe Bin Bar Sinai, Be'achav v'chodesh ha-sheni b'shana ha-sheni. Sitam Eretz Yisrayim Limor. And in Perek Tet, we have Hashem speaking to Moshe a month earlier. Tell him to do the Korban Pesach. By definition, the Torah does not record things in chronological order. Okay. However, that principle works in, let's say, Bamidbar, where we're not concerned with the story, we're concerned with the mitzvot that are being presented. And first you want to give the census, and then you want to give the preparations for leaving, which really start after the Mishkan is built, and you go backwards. But when you're telling a story, a narrative, it's critical to stay in order, otherwise the whole story doesn't make sense. Because a whole thing of a story is this happened, then that happened, that caused this to happen. This guy died, which is why he's not around to help somebody. You can't have him suddenly around when he was dead. So sequence is critical. Sequence takes a back seat to another consideration. And that is, I guess you might call it literary smoothness. Imagine if we were to tell the story of several people and do it in real time. You'd have to have essentially a split screen. All right, so as an example of that, at the end of Chaye Sarah, Yitzchak gets married. How old is Yitzchak when he marries? 40, which makes Avram how old? 140. Right? 100, easy. Avram's 100 when Yitzchak is born. After that, we hear about Avram marrying another woman, having a bunch of kids, and then Avram dying. Avram dies at what age? 175, which means how old is Yitzchak? 75, which means Yitzchak is already the proud parent of two 15-year-old twins by that time. After we hear about Avram's death and burial, and after about Yishmael's death, which is even later, now we hear the story of Yitzchak and Yitzchak having kids. So it's not in order, but there it's not in order for a simple reason. You can't go in order, because if you go in order, you're going to zigzag, wait, time out, Avram, step aside for half a pasuk, it's going to be weird. So what do? We finish the Avram story. Finished? Now, the Yishmael story, finish that, that's quick. We don't have much interest in that. Now let's go to the Yitzchak story. Okay, I get that. But now I'm going to suggest something which is far more of an invasion to chronological sequence and invasion to the story. What I suggest is that the story of Yitzchak is told out of order. In other words, that the entire parsha that happens in Gerar happens during the 20 years between the marriage and the kids. Which explains several things. It explains why Yitzchak's able to pass Rivka off as his sister, who's young, without kids. Why Yitzchak and Rivka are seen sporting, like, you know, relative newlyweds. That Esav's not there to help him at all, because Esav doesn't exist yet. That Yaakov and Esav don't have to be worried about during the famine, because they don't exist yet. And what I've done is I've, with great liberty, which you could do much easier with a computer than by hand, kind of reordered things. Let's take a look at it on the red page. And it really starts, the key to this starts really at the end of Chaye Sarah. But let's first look at the parashim. Eila toldot Yitzchak ben Avram, Avram hovid Yitzchak, vahi Yitzchak ben 40 shana b'kachtot rivka b'aptuol armim padan Aram, achot lavan armim lo li'isha vahi ra'am b'aretz. Right? Yitzchak marries Rivka, Yitzchak's 40, she's from Aram. Right? And now there's a famine. And Yitzchak and Rivka, the newlyweds, go down to there, they want to leave. Hashem says, they'll stay here. By the way, Yanina indicates Avram's still alive and Avram's still in the land. Either way you read it. And they come down, and Yitzchak is this young, tough guy who stands up against the police team, and he impresses everybody, and then Avimelech comes and makes a shvuah with him. All of that happens. Right? And he comes back to Beersheba, having had a very testy
confrontational, but ultimately financially successful stay in Gerar. He comes back to Be'er Sheva, and then what happens? Yitzchak prays for a child. Rivka gets pregnant. Rivka then prays. What is this? They get the nevuah. She gives birth. The kids grow up. And the kids go their different ways, etc. And then Yaakov is making food. Parenthetically, just where is that whole scene happening when Esav comes in and says, I want some of the red stuff? Where is it? Where are they? So if you assume they're in the house, we have a big problem.
He could have gone to his mom's.
Why is Yaakov cooking? Why is Yaakov cooking?
The veil is for Avram.
Okay, but some shot of this is that they're older than 15. They don't seem like 15-year-old boys, right? The presentation here is a little bit older, but lo chashuv. Even if so, nothing sexist here. But who should be cooking? Either we would assume Rivka, or more likely, some slaves. It's a very rich family. Not be told that Yaakov's cooking. But let's think about it. What does Esav do for a living?
Hunts.
And he's a hunter, along with being a field man. What does Yaakov do for a living? He's a shepherd. So where are they? They're very likely somewhere far away. And Esav comes home from the hunt. What's home? He comes to the tent. And who's the guy making the food? The one who stays in the tent. That's Yaakov. Just a side point about that whole scene. Okay, so the whole thing finishes, and Esav says, give me the food. He says, sell the Bechora. By the way, what's the price for the Bechora? What's the price for the Bechora? So the Radak's father says, I'll take a simple shot. He says, the price for the Bechora is a price they'll set later. Do me a favor, don't make me think that a bowl of soup is enough for a Bechora. It's not.
Right?
The price of Bechorah is set. The meal is the confirmation of the deal. We find this throughout Tanakh. When people make some sort of a treaty or a deal, they sign it over a meal. And so the meal is just, you know, I will agree to sell you the Bechorah at a later point for a price that we'll agree on. And the deal that's confirming it is, you're going to give me the food. The food is the Hechatims. Okay. So they finish that piece. Now take a look at the order here. By the way, what's our opinion about Esav at this point in the story? Good or bad? We're not very high. We don't esteem him very much. Why? Because he's hungry stuff, and using some of the red stuff, and he's willing to sell away his future because he says, I'm going to die today.
But I'm still confused about something.
Well, let me just finish out. I'm just finish for a second. Right? And so our opinion of Esav is not very high. And the last words we hear are Vayivez Esav et ha-Bechora. Esav degrades the Bechora. That leads to the famous comments of the Ibn Ezra, that family was actually very poor at this point, and there was nothing to be inherited. All right. And what's the next thing? Vayi Esav v'noim shana v'ikach et basmat, etc. Meaning, the very next thing that happens in our story that we hear is that Esav marries two women, which means we continue to find Esav's stock plummeting. And as the flow is very good. So the real question we've got to ask is, if this is accurate, and it makes sense, why did the Torah tell the story out of order? Why did it plug in the middle of their events? Why did it jump ahead 20 years, have the kids born, the prayer, the nevuah, the birth, the growing up, the different livelihoods, the whole scene in the tent or wherever it is, and then the sale of the Bechora, and then go back to real time? Why did it jump ahead 20 years and come back? Yeah, Jason, you had a question.
If they were both out in this other place, then why would Esav not expect that he would have food when he came back to the tent?
Why would he not expect?
I mean,
maybe he came back early. Maybe he came back earlier. Maybe he had a very bad day. Maybe he was impatient. We find that Esav's got, like I said, issues with impulse control.
It almost seems like they're joking in a certain sense, because why would he... Why would this meal all of a sudden take on such a big thing?
Again, because Esav today happens to either, maybe he was in terrible danger and he figures like his life is forfeit and he gave up early, and he says, some of the Rishonim say, because I'm a hunter, which means I have a very dangerous lifestyle, and so I don't have a future to look forward to. So what do I care about a Bechora? Or might be, I feel so hungry, I'm going to die. Right? Different ways to read it, but it seems like that's what's going on. So why would this shift happen? And I think this whole shift happens because of what happens at the end of Chaye Sarah. See, we have a problem which is called cholent. I don't know if I can say it in Machlok Meal, but there is a problem called cholent. What's the problem? Problem is that you hear the parasha Shabbat morning, and maybe you hear a drasha in the parasha during davening. You're probably reading a bunch of handouts from the internet during davening about the parasha. And you come home, and you have lunch, and maybe people are talking about the parasha, and you eat cholent. Since you eat cholent, what do? You go to sleep. You wake up, you go to shul, and what do you hear? The next parasha. And that parasha's already gone. What we often don't do is we don't see the connection between the end of one parasha and the beginning of the next, because there's cholent in the middle. Right? There's like kind of a mental break of shachrit to mincha. So there are people I know who are very makpid to avoid this, so they daven shachrit so late that they have mincha right away and they see the connection. Just kidding. All right. So if you take a look at the top of the page with the red on it, at the end of Chaye Sarah, for reasons we already talked about, we get the summation of the end of Avram's life. And it ends with Ve'eli Yimei Shnei Chaye Avraham Asher Chay Miyad Shana V'Shvim Shana V'Chamesh Shanim. And then what? He's gathered to his people. By the way, why do they use that term? Gathered to his people, where did that come from? So how do they bury in pre-millennial, really in first, second millennium BCE? How do they bury? They buried in caves. And in the cave, if it was possible, you would have like a rock bed. And you put the dead person on the rock bed. And you'd have maybe two or three of them. Maybe you'd have more. You know, had a lot of money. You had a fancy catacomb. But what happened when Aunt Doris died and there was no room for Aunt Doris because all the beds were taken? What would you do? You take whoever had died longest ago, who is now basically a pile of bones, and you throw the bones into the middle into a pit. And then Aunt Doris would have a bed. And a couple hundred years later or less, Aunt Doris would end up there and when Uncle Maury would go, right? Not her uncle, husband, because some years later, but you know, right? That pit was called the Osef, the gathering place. And you literally were gathered to your people. Another phrase for that is, v'shachavta im avotecha, you will lie with your ancestors. It's not some sort of mythic term. It really means your bones are going to end up in the same pit with your ancestors. That's how they buried. Now we use it sort of metaphorically. So Avram is gathered to his people, right? Which, by the way, is now a borrowed term because his father's buried somewhere in Turkey and he's buried in Hebron. But now the term has become an idiom for dying. All right, so now, Vayikbruoto Yitzchak v'Yishmael ben Avram me'arah tamachpelah, they bury in Marah of Machpelah, El stay Ephron metzoch achiti ashoch ne'im amrei, the field of Ephron, good. Hasadeh shakon Avram me'epnecheid, again we go over the contract, Chamakuba Avraham v'sarah yishto, so when Avram dies, what does Hashem do? He blesses Yitzchak. What does he bless Yitzchak? The Ramban says very clearly, with wealth. Okay, Chazal have a different thing, it's the Chum Avilim, but simple pshat is, Yitzchak does well. Where does Yitzchak live? Near Be'er Sheva, in the desert outside of Be'er Sheva, at the same Be'er that Hagar had that first, that vision with the Malach. Okay. And then we are introduced to Yishmael. And we're told, Ve'elech Shechaye Yishmael, Elo Todot Yishmael, Shechaye Yishmael. Very nice. Why do we need to know that Yishmael had 10 kids, 12 kids? Who cares? Because what did Hashem promise Avram? But what did Hashem promise Avram? Correct. And that comes later with the Dual Esav too. You're going to have lots of kids. So this is Avtacha for that. But what did Hashem tell Avram when Avram was told by Sarah, send the kid out? He said, I don't want to send the kid out. He said, listen to Sarah because, don't worry, Yishmael will live, but who's your main man? Yitzchak. So here we're reading it. And what do you read? Eila Toldot Yishmael. He's got 12 big guys, big machers all over the place. All right? Now, let's read the story of Yitzchak. Here's Yitzchak, the one who's promised. The one who's supposed to be the father, the rest of the line. What do we read about him? He goes here and he goes there and he gets in fights with people and he's got no kids. So what does the Torah do right away to show the promise of Abraham and don't give you even a minute of thinking that it didn't happen? Immediately after we get Toldot Yishmael, we get Toldot Yitzchak, and we jump ahead to tell the story of their birth and their growing up and the Nevuah being fulfilled. And by the way, that Nevuah is also part of the Nevuah to Avraham, because when Avraham said to, when Hashem said to Avraham, Sarai Ishtecha, Lo Tikra et Shma Sarai, Ki Sarah Shma, don't call her Sarai, she's Sarah, I'm going to bless her, and she will be the mother of nations. How many kids does Sarah have?
One.
So how is Sarah the mother of nations? That's Rivka's nevuah. Because Yitzchak is going to have two kids who will be nations. Right? And so this whole piece has to be put right here to juxtapose it with the story of Yishmael's kids. So that again, we don't walk around thinking, oh yeah, Yishmael's blessed, and Yitzchak, who's the real bracha, is left bereft. So what the Torah does is it jumps ahead, tells us that story to show us the Haftacha, and then says, okay, now we're going to fill in blanks and tell you all the stuff that Yitzchak did in the meantime during those 20 years of barrenness while he was acting as a dink, you know, double income, no children, right? And there's no kids yet, and all the things that Yitzchak did, which now become critical because they become an echo of, and if you excuse me for saying so, an improvement on, a step up from a lot of the things that Avram did in his life also. And then what do? We get back into real time, which is Vayhi Esav ben 40 shana. So what happens is, we tell the story, we jump ahead to the birth, then we go and fill in the backstory of Yitzchak and his relationship with the Plishtim and the Shvuah and everything else, and then we go back to the timeline that we're at, which is after the sale of the Bechorah, Esav marries, doesn't go well, and then we jump ahead, we don't know how long, but some years, until Yitzchak thinks he's going to die, and that sets, of course, the famous last huge act of this parasha.